And today we'll hear from mantra number 8, purport. Mantra 8 says, such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since a time immemorial. Purport. Here is a description of the transcendental and eternal form of the Absolute Personality of Godhead. The Supreme Lord is not formless. He has his own transcendental form, which is not at all similar to the forms of the mundane world. The forms of the living entities in this world are embodied in material nature, and they work like any material machine. The anatomy of a material body must have a mechanical construction with veins and so forth, but the transcendental body of the Supreme Lord has nothing like veins. It is clearly stated here that he is unembodied, which means that there is no difference between his body and his soul. Nor is he forced to accept a body according to the laws of nature, as we are. In materially conditioned life, the soul is different from the gross embodiment and subtle mind. For the Supreme Lord, however, there is never any such difference between him and his body and mind. He is the complete whole, and his mind, body, and he himself are all one and the same. In the Brahma Samhita 5.1, there is a similar description of the Supreme Lord. He is described there as Sakchit Ananda Vigraha, which means that he is the eternal form fully representing transcendental existence, knowledge, and bliss. As such, he does not require a separate body or mind as we do in material existence. The Vedic literature clearly states that the Lord's transcendental body is completely different from ours. Thus, he is sometimes described as formless. This means that he has no form like ours, and that he is devoid of a form we can conceive of. In the Brahma Samhita 5.32, it is further stated that with each and every part of his body, he can do the work of the other senses. This means that the Lord can walk with his hands, accept things with his legs, see with his hands and feet, eat with his eyes, etc. In the Shruti mantras, it is also said that although the Lord has no hands and legs like ours, he has a different type of hands and legs, by which he can accept all that we offer him and run faster than anyone. These points are confirmed in this 8th mantra through the use of words like Shukram, omnipotent. The Lord's worshipable form, Archa Vigraha, which is installed in temples by authorized acharyas who have realized the Lord in terms of mantra 7. The Lord's worshipable form, Archa Vigraha, which is installed in temples by authorized acharyas who have realized the Lord in terms of mantra 7, is non-different from the original form of the Lord. The Lord's original form is that of Sri Krishna, and Sri Krishna expands himself into an unlimited number of forms such as Baladev, Rama, Nrisimha, and Varaha. All of these forms are one of the same personality of Godhead. Similarly, the Archa Vigraha, worshipped in temples, is also an expanded form of the Lord. By worshipping the Archa Vigraha, one can at once approach the Lord, who accepts the service of a devotee by his omnipotent energy. The Archa Vigraha, or the Lord of the Lord, descends at the request of the acharyas, the holy teachers, and works exactly in the original way of the Lord by virtue of the Lord's omnipotence. Foolish people who have no knowledge of Sri Ishapanishad or any of the other Shruti mantras consider the Archa Vigraha, which is worshipped by pure devotees, to be made of material elements. This form may be seen as material by the imperfect eyes of foolish people or Kanishta Adhikaris, but such people do not know that the Lord, being omnipotent and omniscient, can transform matter into spirit and spirit into matter as he desires. In the Bhagavad Gita 9:11-12, the Lord regrets the fallen condition of men with little knowledge, who deride him because he descends like a man into this world. Such poorly informed persons do not know the omnipotence of the Lord. Thus the Lord does not manifest himself in full to the mental speculators. He can be appreciated only in proportion to one's surrender to him. The fallen condition of the living entities is due entirely to forgetfulness of their relationship with God. In this mantra, as well as in many other Vedic mantras, it is clearly stated that the Lord has been supplying goods to the living entities from time immemorial. A living being desires something, and the Lord supplies the object of that desire in proportion to one's qualification. If a man wants to be a high court judge, he must acquire not only the necessary qualifications, but also the consent of the authority who can award the title of high court judge. The qualifications in themselves are insufficient for one to occupy the post. It must be awarded by some superior authority. Similarly, the Lord awards enjoyment to living entities in proportion to their qualifications, but good qualifications in themselves are not sufficient to enable one to receive awards. The mercy of the Lord is also required. Ordinarily, the living being does not know what to ask from the Lord, nor which post to seek. When the living being comes to know his constitutional position, however, he asks to be accepted into the Transcendental Association of the Lord in order to render transcendental loving service unto him. Unfortunately, living beings, under the influence of material nature, ask for many other things, and they are described in the Bhagavad Gita 2.41 as having divided or splayed intelligence. Spiritual intelligence is one, but mundane intelligence is diverse. In Srimad Bhagavatam 7.5.30-31, someone can grab that please, it is stated that those who are captivated by the temporary beauties of the external energy forget the real aim of life, which is to go back to Godhead. Forgetting this, one tries to adjust things by various plans and programs. But this is like chewing that which has already been chewed. Nonetheless, the Lord is so kind that he allows the forgetful living entity to continue in this way without interference. Thus, this mantra of Sri Upanishad uses the very appropriate word, yata-tatyataha, indicating that the Lord rewards the living entities just in pursuance of their desires. So what does the word yata-tatyataha mean? The Lord rewards the living entities just in pursuance of their desires. So is that good news or bad news? Depends on your desire, right? But overall, it's really good news for those who become aware that by refining their desires, purifying the heart, clarifying what is actually the self-interest of a living being, then the reciprocation is instantaneously given by the Lord. In fact, he's always waiting to reciprocate with us. In the prayers given by Gajendra, he says, Gajendra says, that the Lord is never lazy. He's always attentive. It's not that he's left us here and he's inattentive to what's going on or to what our situation here is or to what our desires are. He's fully attentive. And at any time when my desires and intentions are turned towards his service, then he reciprocates and he makes all arrangements. Brahmanda Brahmate Kon Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prashadi Pai Pati Lakta Bij. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told Rupa Goswami that that Krishna, who's within everyone's heart, makes a complete arrangement for a living being to come in contact with good guidance. And through that good guidance, then the person comes in contact with Krishna. Actually, we're always in contact with Krishna, but because my attention is turned away from Krishna, then all my trouble starts. At night, when there's darkness, I mistake a snake for a rope for a snake. Just while we were in Big Sur over the weekend, we went to visit Jamuna and Todd and the kids, and they took us on a trail. And there was a piece of seaweed on the trail that looked very much like a snake. It was in the shape of a snake, and it was curled on the path. And when I was walking down the path, for a split second I thought snake, and then I thought there's no snake, and I walked over. And on the way back, I saw another person walking along, and he jumped when he saw the seaweed. And I thought, it wasn't just me. It does look like a snake. And I was remembering that the fear that one experiences in this material world, according to the Srimad Bhagavatam, is due to this mistake of forgetting Krishna, looking away from Krishna, and therefore everything looks scary. And the scariest thing of all is the fact that I'm being stalked by the tigress of death, and at any time I can be swallowed, as Prabhupada says in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, that we are being swallowed by the tigress of death. And it's a fearful situation until one actually realizes that I'm in quality as the same as Krishna. And when I realize my constitutional position as a servant of Krishna, that's a really good position. In the material world, everything's relatively a bad condition, because even when it's good, you're going to lose it anyway, so that makes it worse almost. But when we realize that our condition, our position is that we're eternally servants of the complete whole, who's all opulent, and that it can never be altered, and that whatever service we do to him is never taken back, it's never diminished, then we become wealthy. We become happy at every minute, no matter what our external condition is. So understanding this mantra that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is actually yata-tyat-yataha, that he's dwelling within the heart and he's rewarding all of our desires, is a wake-up call to those who read it and understand that they have a relationship with Krishna, that he's all-merciful and all-powerful, and therefore they take up sadhana, this practice by which they can refine their desires and desire only to serve Krishna. If a living being wants to go to hell, the Lord allows him to do so without interference. And if he wants to go back home, back to Godhead, the Lord helps him. God is described here as Paribhu, the greatest of all. No one is greater than or equal to him. Other living beings are described here as beggars who ask goods from the Lord. The Lord supplies the things the living entities desire. If the entities were equal to the Lord in potency, if they were omnipotent and omniscient, there would be no question of their begging from the Lord even for so-called liberation. Real liberation means going back to Godhead. Liberation as conceived by an impersonalist is a myth. And begging for sense gratification has to continue eternally until the beggar comes to his spiritual senses and realizes his constitutional position. Only the Supreme Lord is self-sufficient. When Lord Krishna appeared on earth 5,000 years ago, he displayed his full manifestation as the personality of Godhead through his various activities. In his childhood, he killed many powerful demons, such as Agasura, Bakasura, Shakatasura, and there was no question of his having acquired such power through any extraneous endeavor. He lifted Govardhan Hill without ever practicing weightlifting. He danced with the gopis without social restriction and without reproach. Although the gopis approached him with a paramour's feelings of love, the relationship between the gopis and Lord Krishna was worshipped even by Lord Chaitanya, who is a strict sannyasi and rigid follower of disciplinary regulations. To confirm that the Lord is always pure and uncontaminated, Sri Ishapanishad describes him as Shudham, antiseptic, and Apapavidham, prophylactic. He is antiseptic in the sense that even an impure thing can be purified just by touching him. The word prophylactic refers to the power of his association. As mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita 9:30-31, a devotee may appear to be a sudarachara, not well behaved in the beginning, but he should be accepted as pure because he is on the right path. This is due to the prophylactic nature of the Lord's association. The Lord is also a papavidham because sin cannot touch him. Even if he acts in a way that appears to be sinful, such actions are all good, for there's no question of his being affected by sin. Because of, in all circumstances he is shudham, most purified, he is often compared to the sun. The sun extracts moisture from many untouchable places on the earth, yet it remains pure. In fact, it purifies obnoxious things by virtue of its sterilizing powers. If the sun, which is a material object, is so powerful, then we can hardly begin to imagine the purifying strength of the all-powerful Lord. And we can have his association through chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. There, just by saying his name, Krishna, the name Krishna and Krishna himself are completely the same. Binat dvam namin namino. It means there's no difference at all. And when we use our tongue to say the holy name, and when we use our ears to hear the holy name, then we're purifying our senses and our existence by saying the mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So as this verse points out, the problem is not with Krishna. The problem is with me. And this is the beginning of all advancement in life, and that is taking responsibility. Once I take responsibility for whatever situation I'm in now, then I can solve the problem. Once I admit that I have a problem, in other words, that it's my problem, then I can do something about it. And if I don't have a problem, that is, if I don't admit that I have a problem, then there's nothing I can do about it. So then I'm just stuck. However, according to this verse and the invocation verse, which says, Om Purnamada Purnamidam, Krishna is perfect, his creation is perfect, whatever situation I'm in now is perfect, even though it may seem to me to be relatively imperfect or undesirable. One way or another, I desired it, and I got what I desired. So Krishna is fulfilling all of my desires. Now, when I'm in ignorance and I desire things which are detrimental to my own good. And these are called anartas, these kinds of desires. That really means false values. Arta means something which is valuable. Anarta means something which is really not valuable. It may even be detrimental. I may be working very hard and using my intelligence, in fact, to satisfy these anartas, and I may look brilliant while I'm doing it, but because I'm satisfying something which is a false value, I am in a counterproductive situation, and whatever work I'm putting in is actually lost. It's wasted. In fact, it's entangling me even more. But by the process of Krishna consciousness, I can reverse this situation and become aware of what my real interest in life is. And someone who does become aware of his or her real interest in life, that person will act in Krishna consciousness. Because that's what we do. We act according to our interests. Now, Krishna reciprocates, and as we heard in this purport, yayata mam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham, and yatat yat yataha, which means that Krishna rewards us just according to what our desire is. And interestingly, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, fifth canto, in the chapter called The Description of Jambudweep, there is a verse which says that if someone asks, if a devotee asks Krishna for material benedictions, Krishna will fulfill those desires, but he does it in such a way that the asker won't ask for such benedictions again. And even though he didn't ask for it, Krishna gives himself to that person, or he brings the person to his shelter, even if that was not desired by that person. And the verse ends by saying this is a special mercy of the Supreme Personality of God. Dishyati artitam artito yata. That he gives out the arta, whatever you're asking for, he gives it. But especially for those who have begun the path of devotional service, if they ask for something detrimental, Krishna makes special arrangements for them so that they get purified of that desire and they're brought to Krishna's lotus feet. Is it in your shloka book? I don't know. I don't think so. Dishyati artitam. Artito yata. You can find it in the Srimad Bhagavatam in Satyam Dishyati. I'm sorry, I gave you the wrong beginning. It's Satyam Dishyati Artitam Artito Yata. Naivartito Yet Puna Artita Yata. Swayam Vitate Bhajatam Anichatam Ichapitanam Nijapada Pallavam. Is it there? Can we have 5th canto, 19th chapter, 27th verse? Pooja, could you grab that? 5:19, 27. So far, all good news, right? Everything that we're talking about is good news? Or are you disappointed? Yeah. 5:19:24. Satyam jishiti artitam artito rinam. Well, we obviously have the wrong verse. Any questions so far or comments? Here it is. Any questions so far? Any objection? Okay, then I'm going to read this purport. The translation is, the Supreme Personality of Godhead fulfills the material desires of a devotee who approaches him with such motives. But he does not bestow benedictions upon the devotee that will cause him to demand more benedictions again. However, the Lord willingly gives the devotee shelter at his own lotus feet, even though such a person does not aspire for it. And that shelter satisfies all his desires. That is the Supreme Personality's special mercy. Purport. The devotees mentioned in the previous verse approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead with material motives. But this verse explains how such devotees are saved from those desires. Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.10 advises, Akama sarva kama va moksha kama udara dihi. Tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Whether one is freed from all material desires, is full of material desires, or desires to become one with the Supreme, he should engage in devotional service. In this way, not only will the devotee's desire be fulfilled, but the day will come when he will have no other desire than to serve the lotus feet of the Lord. One who engages in the service of the Lord with some motive is called sakama bhakta. And one who serves the Lord without any motives is called akama bhakta. Krishna is so merciful that he turns a sakama bhakta into an akama bhakta. A pure devotee, an akama bhakta, has no material motives, is satisfied simply to serve the lotus feet of the Lord. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 6:22. Yam labha chaparam labham manyante narikam tata. If one engages in the service of the lotus feet of the Lord, he does not want anything more. This is the highest stage of devotional service. The Lord is so kind to even a sakama bhakta, a motivated devotee, that he satisfies his desires in such a way that one day he becomes an akama bhakta. Dhruva Maharaj, for example, became a bhakta with the motive of getting a better kingdom than that of his father, but finally he became an akama bhakta and said to the Lord, Swamin kritarto smi varam nayache. My dear Lord, I am very satisfied simply to serve your lotus feet. I do not want any material benefits. Sometimes it is found that a small child eats dirty things, but his parents take away the dirty things and offer him his sandesh or some other sweetmeat. Devotees who aspire for material benedictions are compared to such children. The Lord is so kind that he takes away their material desires and gives them the highest benediction. Therefore, even for material motives, one should not worship anyone other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One must fully engage himself in the devotional service of the Lord, so that all his desires will be fulfilled, and at the end, he can go back home, back to Godhead. This is explained in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya 23, 37 through 39 and 41 as follows. Anyakami. Can we have Madhya Lila 22? Madhya 22:37. Anyakami, a devotee may desire something other than service to the lotus feet of the Lord. Jadikari Krishnara Bhajana. But if he engages in Lord Krishna's service, na magiteha Krishna taridena swacharana. Krishna gives him shelter under his lotus feet, even though he does not aspire for it. What do you think of that? He didn't ask for it. A devotee may desire something other than service to the lotus feet of the Lord. But if he engages in Lord Krishna's service, Krishna gives him shelter at his lotus feet, even though he does not aspire for it. Do we have a light of the Bhagavat? We should have a light of the Bhagavat. Lord Krishna says, he is engaged in my service, magi vishaya sukh, but he wants the benefits of material sense gratification. Amrita chadi visha magi. Such a devotee is like a person who asks for poison instead of nectar. E bada murka. This is his foolishness. Ami bignya. But I am experienced. Krishna is saying, I am experienced. E murke bishai kena diba. Why should I give such a foolish person the dirty things of material enjoyment? Swa charnamrita. It would be better for me to give him shelter at my lotus feet. Bishaya bulaiba. I shall cause him to forget all material desires. Kama lagi Krishna bhaje. If one engages in the service of the Lord for sense gratification, pai Krishna rashe, the result is that he ultimately gets a taste for serving the lotus feet of the Lord. Kama chadi das hoite hoi abilash. He then gives up all material desire and wants to become an eternal servant of the Lord. You like it? You're smiling. You like it, right? It's good. 22:37. Translation here, if those who desire material enjoyment are merging into the existence of the Absolute Truth, engage in the Lord's transcendental loving service, they will immediately attain shelter at Krishna's lotus feet, although they did not ask for it. Krishna is therefore very merciful. Krishna says, if one engages in my transcendental loving service, but at the same time wants the opulence of material enjoyment, he is very, very foolish. Indeed, he is just like a person who gives up ambrosia to drink poison. Since I am very intelligent, why should I give this fool material prosperity? Instead, I shall induce him to take the nectar of the shelter of my lotus feet and make him forget illusory material happiness. Shall I read the purport? Yes. Yeah? Those who are interested in material enjoyment are known as bhukti kami. One who is interested in merging into the effulgence of Brahman or perfecting the mystic yoga system is not a devotee at all. Devotees do not have such desires. However, if a karmi, jnani, or yogi somehow contacts a devotee and renders devotional service, Krishna immediately awards him love of God and gives him shelter at his lotus feet, although he may have no idea how to develop love of Krishna. If a person wants material profit from devotional service, Krishna condemns such materialistic desires. To desire material opulence while engaging in devotional service is foolish. Although the person may be foolish, Krishna, being all intelligent, engages him in his devotional service in such a way that he gradually forgets material opulence. The point is that we should not try to exchange loving service for material prosperity. If we are actually surrendered to the lotus feet of Krishna, our only desire should be to satisfy Krishna. That is pure Krishna consciousness. Surrender means not that we demand something from the Lord, but that we are completely dependent on his mercy. If Krishna likes, he may keep his devotee in a poverty-stricken condition, or if he likes, he may keep him in an opulent position. The devotee should not be concerned in either case. He should simply be very serious about trying to satisfy the Lord by rendering him devotional service. And then again, in this Chaitanya Charitamrita, is quoted this Bhagavatam verse that I brought up earlier, Satyam dishati artitam artito nrinam naivartito yat punar artita yata swayam vidate bhajatam anichatam icha pitanam nijapada palavam. Whenever Krishna is requested to fulfill one's desire, he undoubtedly does so, but he does not award anything which, after being enjoyed, will cause one to petition him again and again to fulfill further desires. When one has other desires but engages in the Lord's service, Krishna forcibly gives one shelter at his lotus feet, where one will forget all other desires. That's from Bhagavatam 5.19.27. Okay, yes.
Regarding the asking Krishna to fulfill the desires, normally when one has the desires, those desires are applicable to his current environment, to his current situation. For example, he has some desire, and if Krishna fulfills it and then in the next life, for example, that may not be of much relevance. For example, you know, just to give an example, if someone has a desire to drink a nice cold drink in hot weather, he may have it. But if that desire is fulfilled in a winter when he is living in a very cold place, you know, that desire doesn't make is not relevant at that point. So when we say, you know, Krishna fulfills the desires, are we referring to fulfilling the desires in some future lives or the present life? Because the relevance may be lost if it is delayed.
Well, if you remember from the purport, he fulfills your desires as you deserve also. Because you have a contract with Maya also, and you have to fulfill the terms of that contract as well. And Krishna would like to extricate the soul from that situation. Therefore, he gives his instruction how to get out of it. He also sends good lawyers who know the books and the loopholes to, you know, to get people out. And, you know, how he fulfills desires of the living entity through the agency of material nature is a complex subject because it has to do with the intricacies of karma. But that Krishna explains in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Purusha Prakriti Stohi Punkte Prakriti Jan Gunan Karanam Gunasangosya Sadasad Yoni Janmasu. That a living entity undoubtedly has desires, and when he associates with the modes of material nature to fulfill those desires, then he gets good and bad according to his association with the material nature. And Krishna is all overseeing and permitting these things to go on. When Krishna fulfills someone's desire directly, however, as is being mentioned here, the point is when one takes to devotional service but has material desires and is asking for Krishna for something material, he is expert at fulfilling their desires, but in such a way that they may not desire it again. And just in response to your question, I go back to the fact that Krishna's creation is perfect, and he's perfect, and he has a perfect way of fulfilling our desires, or not. And you needn't worry. I mean, especially as a devotee, you shouldn't worry, because you're already situated in devotional service. And Krishna can do many things at one time. He fulfills many purposes with one action. And how he fulfills your desire and in what sequence, that is up to him. I mean, you may desire something and then later you get that desire after you've already given up the desire, that is, and think, oh, I didn't want this after all, but still you have to take it. And Prahlad, you know, Krishna gives benedictions and also, you know, our minds change. In the material sense, we may desire something and then the desire is fulfilled, and by the time we even, you know, the desire is fulfilled, we've moved on, we don't want it. That's the fault of the flickering mind anyway. The enjoyment of the material world is, Krishna explains, prajahati yada kaman sarvan parta manogatan. He says it's a product of mental concoction anyway. You said, you know, I want a cold drink and it's hot, but I get the cold drink when it's cold instead or something. these are all relative considerations that take place in the mind. At one time, I think something tastes good, and the other time, I think it tastes bad. It's all kind of it's a mental concoction, those desires. So those, the fulfillment of desires in the material plane anyway, never really becomes satisfying. I mean, whatever you get, you may think you want something, and then you get it, and then you'll think, oh, I didn't really want it, or it wasn't really good enough anyway. So whether you got the cold drink on a hot day or vice versa, you're going to be dissatisfied one way or another. Rakshit?
I had a couple of questions related to that. The first one is that based on this discussion, should devotees be not asking for material desires at all? That is one. And the other is there a distinction between asking for a material desire and what is called a material need? Like, there are some.
There is a difference, actually. Yes. The first question, we shouldn't ask for anything material because, as is mentioned in this verse, that's foolish. Krishna says, you're after ambrosia, but you're asking for poison instead. So it's foolish. So why be foolish? Why not ask for the correct thing? Therefore, we repeat many of the prayers of the great Mahajans and Acharyas. For instance, when we repeat Prahlad Maharaj's prayers, a prayer we're saying, if you at all desire to give me a benediction, then please give me the benediction that there's no material desires within my heart, that all I want is pure devotional service. That's an intelligent thing to ask, and therefore we follow in the footsteps of the great souls and we ask such things. And someone who develops such a propensity. One more Sri Upanishad soul. One who develops such a propensity to ask for those things from the core of their heart, sincerely wanting that I have no material desires, a very fortunate person. So we should ask, follow in the footsteps of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Nadanam, Najanam, Nasundarim, Kavitam Va Jagadisha Kamaye, Mama Janmani Janmani Shrede Bhavatad Bhakti Rahai Tuki Twai. However, question number two was, if there is a dire situation or a need that comes up like an emergency, and we ask for something. Rupa Goswami explains this in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that it is not outside the realm of pure devotional service. And the reason it's not is because it's not the nature of the devotee to ask anything from the Lord. But under duress, he or she may ask for help. For instance, Gajendra said as much in his prayers. He said, I know that pure devotees don't ask for anything. But right now, I have a crocodile on my leg. So what can I do? Could you please help me? And, you know, if you have a crocodile on your leg, you may call out to Krishna, please help me, because it hurts. And there are a lot of things that are outside our nature that normally we wouldn't ask for, but in some kind of a situation we ask for it. And Rupa Goswami says, therefore, it's not the nature or the normal course that a devotee would ask for such a thing. But if he or she does under an extreme situation, then that's not outside the realm of pure devotional service. That's considered still within the realm of pure devotional service. But even such situations will one will come to know that we can just depend upon Krishna. The residents of Vrindavan, for instance, when the coward boys play with Krishna, they're always testing fate because they know Krishna's there. And when they saw Agasura, they fully considered the situation that here's a gigantic snake, its lip is touching the sky, it's got huge teeth, it's breathing out this like a hurricane, and it's a very dangerous animal, they said. Let's go inside because Krishna's here. No problem. They thought, he'll save us. And so they just went right in without any hesitation, almost gleefully. They marched right into the belly of the snake, thinking Krishna is there to save me. And pure devotees take shelter of Krishna. We should take shelter of the holy name. Apanasam srutim goran yannama vivashogranan tatasadyo vimucheta yad bipeti swayambayam. This is in the first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, first chapter. And Sutta Goswami says that the name of Krishna, as we already know, it's non-different from Krishna, is feared by fear personified. Therefore, one can take shelter of the name of Krishna. When you chant the holy name, you should remember that Krishna is your protector. He's the shelter of the whole universe, and we need protection. We need shelter. We need shelter from our material desires, whatever might be there, from the turbulent mind, and from all the influences in this world. And we should call out to Krishna, just as the coward boys called out for Krishna every time. When the cowherd men went on a pilgrimage to visit a temple of Durga, they didn't go every year, but during Shivaratri they went this one year, and they camped outside, and there was a temple of Shiva and there was a temple of Durga there, and they were camping outside, and at night while they were sleeping on the ground, a gigantic serpent came and started to swallow up Nanda Maharaj. And all the cowherd men rose the alarm that Nanda was being swallowed, and there was a fire still burning, as they had a campfire. So they pulled burning logs from the fire and they began to beat the snake, but it didn't dissuade him in the least, and he kept swallowing. So then they called out Krishna, and Krishna appeared there, and he touched the snake with his lotus feet, and then that snake was transformed into the demigod Vidyadhara. And then Vidyadhara began offering his obeisances to Krishna and said that in previous life, I had this beautiful body that you see now, and I was a big shot. I had an airplane, and I was flying around in my airplane, and I saw this sage, Angira. And Angira was an ugly sage. And when Vidyadhara, in his puffed up condition, saw the ugly sage, he laughed at him and thought, oh, how ugly. And then the sage, Angira, cursed him and said, oh, become a snake. So in his next life, he became a serpent. And then he said, now I see that it was actually a benediction curse, because now Krishna has touched me with his lotus feet and I've become purified. And he asked to go back to his position in the heavenly planets, and he did. So in Vrindavan, everyone's always calling out for Krishna. Please, Krishna, they take shelter of him. So we should take shelter of the holy name. Apana samsritin goran yannama vivashogranan tatasadya vimucheta yad bipeti swayambayam. Fear personified is afraid of the holy name of Krishna, which is non-different from Krishna. Did that answer your two questions?
Yes, it did.
Okay. Any other question? Yes, Bhakta Zo. We need a microphone in quadrant two, please.
Okay. What requirements are there for someone to be called a devotee of Lord Krishna? What makes somebody a devotee from a karmi?
That's a question that was asked to Lord Chaitanya by the residents of Kuliagram, which is now known as Navadvip. And they came to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and one of a Brahmin from Kuliagram inquired from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, what is a devotee? And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, a devotee is anyone who says Hare Krishna. Like, we have a landlord over here. His name is Nick. And when I've been negotiating with him about something. And so yesterday when I was on the phone, I called him up and he had to put me on hold. But as he picked up the phone, he was on the other line and he goes, oh, it's the Krishna. And then he put me on hold. And I thought, he's over there chanting all the time. You know, oh, Krishna this, Krishna that. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, anyone who can say Krishna is the greatest among the the population. Shastra says it too. I think we brought these verses in the class the other night, but they're very powerful verses from Devahuti. Devahuti appears in the Srimad Bhagavatam as the mother of Lord Kapiladev. And she says, Aho bhatashwa pachato garyan yajiva gre vartite namatubhyam tepustapaste juhuhu sasnar arya brahmanachur nama granantiye te. Oh, what a wonderful thing it is that anyone who's just chanting with the tip of their tongue is considered to have performed all kinds of Vedic rituals, gone on pilgrimage to all these places, has performed all the rites in order to come up to the position of being a Brahmin. In other words, anyone who can say Hare Krishna is an extraordinary person. And then she said, Yanamadeha Shravanadu Kirtanat Yet pravanat yet smaranat pi kuchit shvadho pi sadya savanaya kalpate kutakpunaste bhagavan nudarshanat. That even if a person from a very low birth hears and chants, says Krishna, that person becomes qualified. Their sins are destroyed. So a devotee is anyone who can say Hare Krishna. Can you say Hare Krishna? Hare Krishna. Then they asked Chaitanya Mahaprabhu the next year about who is a devotee. And he said that a devotee is somebody who's always chanting Hare Krishna. That's the devotee who's in the middle platform. Anyone who just says Krishna gets the effect of Namabhas. Means even the indirect rays of the holy name will give somebody liberation. But someone who's always chanting Hare Krishna, they can't stop. That means every day their main focus is to chant. That person, the middle class devotee, the Madhyama Adhikari. And then he said, the topmost devotee is the person when other people see him, they start chanting Hare Krishna. Whoever they are, they look and they go, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. He makes other people chant. So there are different levels of devotees that he mentioned. But the first starts with anybody who can say Krishna. And we also heard in this purport that Krishna gives a definition of the devotee in the famous verse in which he talks about somebody who even is of loose character. And that word is sudarachara. Their achar is sudur. It's very bad. So he says, Api chet sudarachara bhajate mam ananya bhak sadureva samantavya sam yag vyavasito hisaha. That even if a person is performs some abominable action, or if they appear to be of loose character, if they're somehow engaged in devotional service, they are to be considered saintly. And Krishna says this emphatically. And in the next verse, he says, Shri Prambhavati Dharmatma Shashvash Chantim Nagachati Konteya Pratijani Hi Name Bhakti Pranashati. That he says, you can declare it boldly that such a person will quickly come to the topmost position, and that the devotee is never vanquished. So, someone who says Hare Krishna is a devotee. Did that help? Or do you want to ask more about it? Does it help? Okay. Yes. Microphone in quadrant 3, please.
Someone who says Hare Krishna just once is a devotee?
Yeah. Okay. Correct. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
What to speak, says Devahuti, kutakpanaste bhagavan nudarshanat, of somebody who's having direct contact with Krishna all the time, seeing Krishna in the temple like this, and always engaged in devotional service. What to speak of somebody like that? So he's saying the minimum is there, but then somebody who's taken it fully, what to speak of that person? What will be the effect? So Krishna recommends that one subdue the senses. Right? We should subdue the senses. Do you know where he says that? Well, one place is Bhagavad Gita. Say it. Jagarini knows. 439. Oh, who said that? That's that Boomer?
Hansapriya on the phone.
Hansapriya. Hansapriya. Which verse is it, Hansapriya?
It's a 439.
439. That's right. Everyone knows 439. Anyone who was in Big Sur last weekend knows verse 439 because we went over and over verse 439 until everyone memorized it. And that verse, 439, Krishna says, Sharava labhate jnanam tapara samatendriyaha. That one must, a person of faith, somebody, a faithful person who's dedicated to transcendental knowledge and who subdues his senses is eligible to receive transcendental knowledge. And having received it, he quickly attains the supreme spiritual peace. So there are three aspects mentioned in that verse. Shadava labhate jnanam. That a person should have faith. They should be dedicated to transcendental knowledge. And they should subdue the senses. Someone who does these three things, Krishna says, will attain the supreme spiritual peace. So everyone can move up, please, by one space, if you have it. And if you don't have one full space, then take 7.2 inches. Thank you. Welcome, everyone. Nice to see you here tonight. Hare Krishna. Please, have darshan. Shadava labhate jnanam. So Shraddha means faith. It means one who understands that just by doing Krishna bhakti, I will attain all perfection in everything. I don't have to do anything else besides bhakti. In fact, throughout the Shastra, it's mentioned that, first of all, we're debtors. Devarshi bhutapnandrinam pitrinam nakinkaro nayam ranicha rajan. We owe everyone. The demigods are providing us light and water and air and food and everything like that. And Krishna mentions this in the Bhagavad Gita that there's an arrangement that we're supposed to pay back by doing yajna. And if we don't follow the system of yajna, then we become delinquent. And if you don't pay your electric bill for a month, you'll come home to a dark house. And there's a bill to pay. And so Deva, Rishi, the Rishis, they give us all kinds of knowledge. They've taken great pains to actually put this knowledge together. Look at the great pains Prabhupada took to put these books together and make sure that we got them. It was a huge, huge sacrifice. And these are all being passed down. So we have a debt to the Rishis and to ordinary living entities. For instance, the cows are supplying milk to everybody in society. And we have a debt to them. We have a debt to our forefathers. How did we get here without them? Our parents spent so much time raising us, and their parents spent time raising them, and probably wealth has been passed down to you from your parents, wealth of knowledge, and they just cared for your body, even when you didn't say thank you, probably for the first 30 years. And, you know, so there's a debt there. Devarshi bhutatnan rinam pitrinam na kinkaro nayan rinicharajan. But sarvatmana yasharanam sharanyam, somebody who surrendered to Krishna, liquidates all those debts. That's the only person that's free from all the debts. Otherwise, you have to pay. But somebody who dedicates all their energy to serving Krishna, surrenders to Krishna, no longer becomes a debtor to anyone else. And in the Bhagavad Gita, end of the 8th chapter, Krishna also describes Vedeshu, Yagyeshu, Tapasu, Chaiva, that you can, there's all kinds of tapasya you can perform, there's charity you can give, you can go help the homeless, you can do all these kinds of things, but if you do Krishna Bhakti, you already fulfill all those things, you get the result of it. And therefore, a person with this kind of faith, Shraddha Shabde Vishwas Kahi Suridanish Choi Krishna Bhakti Koila Sarva Karma Krita Hoy. Here she understands that by doing Krishna Bhakti, everything is done. All other karmas are fulfilled just because I'm doing Krishna Bhakti. So this is a faithful person. Shraddhaval labhate jnanam. And then a person, then I mentioned that a person must be dedicated to transcendental knowledge. Puja, dictionary, look up dedication. It really means to set aside something as particularly important and to concentrate your attention there and to talk about it and to fix it in your life, some kind of dedication. So you have to be dedicated to transcendental knowledge. You have to be faithful, dedicated to transcendental knowledge. What's an example of being dedicated to transcendental knowledge? In other words, I'm asking, what is an example of someone who's dedicated to transcendental knowledge? Manish? Parikshit Maharaj, he said. In what way?
Like, he has having only 7 days left.
He has only 7 days left. He needs a microphone. Keep going. But he's not considered.
Consider any material thing. He just left everything and just said to
he
hear
didn't
that.
Consider concept. Any material thing. He just dedicated just his time.
His time for knowing the transcendental knowledge from Sukadeva Goswami.
As dedication. Yeah. So the Bhagavatam recommends this also. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. You should be dedicated to the service of the Bhagavatam. There's two kinds of Bhagavat. There's the book Bhagavat and the person Bhagavat. The book Bhagavat is the passive agent, and the person Bhagavat is the living example of the Bhagavatam. They're living the Bhagavatam. And such a person is an active representative who can who you can interact with and hear from. Yes. Dedication.
There's dedicate and there's dedication.
Dedicate.
Okay. Dedicate. One, to set apart for a deity or for religious purposes, consecrate. Two, to set apart for special use, dedicated his money to scientific research. Three, to commit oneself.
Oh, wait, let's look at number two. Say it again.
To set apart for a special use.
To set apart for a special use. So I'll bet most of you in your house, you've set the Bhagavatam apart from all other books, and it's for special use, right? So you're dedicated to transcendental knowledge. I mean, you get a Bhagavatam. Actually, you know, you shouldn't keep the Bhagavatam on the same shelf with the other books. Do you know that? Don't put the Bhagavatam and then you have some Reader's Digest piled on top of it or something like that. It's a deity, or side by side. Just keep it. You should have a dedicated shelf. It's set aside specifically for that. So devotees, you know, they'll set aside a room in their house. In fact, many devotees, when they're looking for a place to live, the first thing they look in the house is what? Where's the temple room? And all the other rooms, they can make do, pretty much, as long as there's a place for the temple room. They set aside, they're dedicated. Yes?
To commit oneself to a particular course of thought or action.
To commit oneself to a particular course of thought or action. Okay?
Four, to address or inscribe a literary work, for example, to someone as a mark of respect or affection.
And tell us what the word means, the basis.
It says dead. It says M-E. It's a Latin root.
That means Middle English. M-E means Middle English.
Okay. And then it's a Latin root from dedicare. Day means apart, plus dedicare means to say.
To say. Okay. Apart and say. Dedicate. Dedicare. Dikar or vikar? Vichar. Dichare. Dichare. Dedicate and to say. So, one who's dedicated to transcendental knowledge, you dedicate by hearing, by setting aside part of your life or all of your life for hearing. I was reading in the biography of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur where he said, I will go on speaking Harikatha until my body wears out. He said, I'll speak Harikatha 24 hours a day. While I'm awake, while I'm dozing, I'll go on speaking Harikatha. I'll speak it in assemblies. I'll speak it to, when I'm alone. And he said, I'll go on speaking until this body wears out one day, and then I'll leave the body behind as I'm speaking Harikatha. This is the process. Tanama rupa charitari sukirtananu smrityo kramena rasanamanasi niyoja. One organizes one's life around this principle of dedication to transcendental knowledge. And over and above this, the Prabhupada says in the purport to the verse, Shraddhavallabhate Jnanam, one must subdue the senses. Look up the word subdue, please. One must subdue the senses. Are your senses subdued? No? When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was performing a play, he asked all his devotees to come, and he said he would dress up as Mahalakshmi, and he told everyone that unless your senses are completely controlled, you shouldn't come see this play, because Mahalakshmi would be so attractive that it would carry away someone who wasn't sense controlled. So immediately Advaitacharya hung his head and he said, I cannot come, I'm not. And then Srivas Thakur said that I am disqualified, I cannot come to watch the play. And Mahaprabhu said, you'll have special mercy that you'll not be affected in any way. You should come and watch the play. The senses are headed by the mind, and the mind is like the blowing wind. It's very difficult to control. So how does one subdue the senses? That's the topic. Do you have the word? Okay.
Subdue, to conquer and subjugate, vanquish. 2. To quiet or bring under control by physical force or persuasion. Take tractable. 3. To make less intense or prominent. Tone down. Yeah, that is.
Okay, so thank you very much. First, I'm going to tell you about Maggie the horse. And Maggie lives in Big Sur. She's a big, beautiful horse, but she thinks she's human or some other smaller animal, because she's a very friendly horse. When we were walking one day up the path, Maggie came and joined us. I think she was aware that we might have been carrying some apples. And she followed us for about a quarter of a mile. And we came to a house up the pathway, and there was a caretaker there who was admiring the horse. And then when Maggie the horse saw that the gate of the house was open, she ran in into the yard. And Jamuna told us, because she knows the horse very well, that whenever somebody's gate is open, Maggie always runs in. She'll put her head in the front door if your door is open to see if there are any treats and anybody wants to feed her. But she's a big horse. So the caretaker saw the horse run into the yard of the place that she was taking care of. And Jamuna said, oh, by the way, she'll eat all the flowers. And so the caretaker immediately thought, oh, I have to get her out of the yard. And then she thought, well, how am I going to do that? How do you move a big horse? And Jamuna told her the secret. And she said, all you have to do is put a little rope around her neck, or even a thread, or even a scarf. Because Maggie is so trained from the time she was little that if you have something, anything around her neck, and you can lead her any way that you want her to go. And so the caretaker looked around, and she had a sweater on, so she took the sweater off and put it around Maggie's neck, and it was easy to lead her around anywhere. So Maggie, the horse, developed this discipline by being trained. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that one can control the mind through practice and by detachment. So this is one of the unique features about being a human being, is that you can employ discipline in your life and practice. And the word abhyas means that you do something repeatedly over and over again until it becomes a solid habit. So you can develop a habit through abhyas, through repeating something. So you have to decide what kind of habit you want to develop and what kind of habit you want to give up. And then you can do it through practice. By the way, I got a letter. It was an invitation to come to this picnic in San Diego. There's a devotee, wonderful devotee named Yudhishthir, who lives in San Diego. And he is the congregational coordinator. And he organizes all kinds of programs for people in the congregation. And he sent me a picture of a recent picnic that they had had. And there must have been 150 devotees there at the picnic. And he told me, he asked if I could come, which I can't. I wish I could. But he said that at the program, there will be a ceremony where the devotees will write down on a piece of paper whatever bad habits they want to give up. And then they stuff those into an effigy of Ravana. And then they shoot him with flaming arrows and burn him. So all of the habits get burned up. Actually, Gyanagni Sarvakarmanam, Krishna mentions this, by the power of transcendental knowledge, it's like it's a fire, Gyana Agni Sarvakarmanam. Any kind of karma, bad habits that I've developed over time can be burned up with fire of perfect knowledge. And also by the practice, first thing, abhyas, which means that I have to decide how to regulate the senses in a positive way and then do that practice every day without fail. And just like a horse gets trained gradually over time, a little bit at a time, the mind can come under control. Our habits can become refined by this abhyas. And just like if you have a tiny little filament, a thread, thin thread, and then you add another thread to it and another thread, after a while you'll have a thick thread, and if you keep adding to it, after some time you'll have a rope, and then it'll be a thick rope. And just like the ropes at Jagannath Puri, when you grab onto the carts, the ropes on the carts in Jagannath Puri, I can't get one hand around it, and I have a big hand, and it's the rope is this thick, and there's no way that you could break that rope. It's so strong. So your good habits, your sadhana, your practice in devotional service becomes like that through this abhyas. And it's recommended by Krishna as a way to subdue the senses. So now you have one tip that you can use anywhere at any time. And you could start today. I have this little book I keep in my pocket. I always have a little book in my pocket because I've found that when ideas or good inspirations come into my mind, if I don't capture them, oftentimes they don't come back, or they'll come back at a time when I can't do anything about it. So one of my practices is to not be lazy. And when an inspiration comes, I have a pen and I have this pad and I always write it down. And I have a lot of these pads. They're full up with good ideas. And if I need a good idea, I just look in there. Well, who thought of that? That's a good idea. And there's a whole collection of them that I can go and refer to. Why did I bring that up? I have no idea. Why? Abhyas. Practice. Oh, in this little book, I have a section that tells my mind, what we're going to do today. In other words, I get to dictate, to subdue the senses, because the mind is a sense. It's the center of all the senses. And if I let my mind decide what we're going to do today, it's going to be a wild ride because my mind has all kinds of ideas. Once one of my good friends, godbrother Pushpadantaprabhu, had two sons, still has two sons, but they were very young at the time. And he told me, he said one day, the trick is I have to wake up way before they do and be ready for them. Because if they get up before I do, I'm finished. So it's the same thing with the mind. The mind's like a, you know, an impudent child, and it wants to do what it wants to do, and it has different moods, and it'll go off in any direction. To subdue the mind, you have to have a plan. You have to have a plan. And if you don't, you got to get yourself a canned plan. You got to decide. So I have this little book, and you can't believe the power of this little book. Because what's written gets done. And it holds power over my mind. My mind wants to go here, there, and everywhere else and do something else. I say, wait a minute, let's look at the book. Sorry, can't help you. It's here in the book. We'll have to do this today. And here you have a simple solution that will cost you not more than a few dollars to subdue the mind. And that's a big thing, because yogis take 10,000 years to try to subdue the mind. But you can do it with a little book and a Parker pen made in England. It costs you $5, ballpoint. So get yourself a pad and decide what your plan is. You see, you have intelligence. As a human being, you have this feature of intelligence that you can utilize over the mind. And you can decide by purified intelligence that what's really good for me today are these three things, and I'm going to do them no matter what anybody else says, including you, Mr. Mind. And then you decide, you write it down, and then you have your plan for the day. And no matter what else happens, do that plan. So controlling the senses means acting according to your plan. Thing is, if you don't have a plan, you won't know whether you're following it or not. And as soon as you have a plan, even if it's the simplest of plans, then you have an idea whether you're on course or off course. Otherwise, you can go anywhere you want, and you can let your mind wander to any other kind of realm, and you won't know the difference. So make a plan. Use abhyas and deep absorption in service. This is another way to subdue the senses. There are examples of this in Shastra. Haridas Thakur is the best example, because he was in a town named Benapul, and there was a envious constable there that really hated Haridas Thakur just because Haridas Thakur was a saint and that people respected him. This man was boiling with envy, and he wanted to defame Haridas Thakur. And he came up with a plan to send a prostitute there to his hut where he was chanting and doing his sadhana. And then he would induce him to some sinful activity, and then they would arrest him and expose him to put it all in the papers and tell everyone what happened. And in the story, there was one prostitute who volunteered to go and do this deed, but on the first day, Haridas Thakur told her that, yes, I will be right with you, anything you want, except I have a vow to finish my rounds. And so I can't do anything until I finish my rounds. And he didn't finish the first day. So she sat and waited. Went back and told the constable that I almost had him. He agreed to the whole thing, but he had to finish his round, so I'm going to go back again. So she went back the next night, and the same thing happened. She was cheated. And on the third night, she became affected by the atmosphere, by the chanting, by the association of Haridas Thakur, and she admitted why she was there. And Haridas Thakur already knew that. And he was only extending himself to the prostitute in order to bring her up to a higher position, which she did come to a higher position, became his disciple, actually. And the plot was foiled. And so being absorbed in deep service means that your desires may come and take a look to see, is this a candidate that I can drag in a certain way? And they'll see that you're busy. And you can even tell them, yeah, sure, no problem, whatever you like, only after I finish my service. But if you're deeply absorbed, there's no end to your service. It'll go on and on. So you take shelter of your seva. Your seva will save you. Take shelter of your seva. So these are three methods for subduing the senses. One is the technique of abhyas. It means to find out a good habit and write it down and then practice it every day until it becomes second nature. And in the beginning, you'll have a situation where, you know, did you know that you don't know what you don't know? Are you aware of that? That you don't know what you don't know? So first of all, you have to, first of all, there's unconscious incompetence. And when I get good association with the Shastra, with an advanced person, then I become consciously incompetent. I should look and see that I'm really incompetent. This is advancement out of unconscious incompetence. It's a good situation to be in when I think I'm really incompetent. Now I'm fully conscious that I am incompetent. Then by making this abhyas and practice, you can become consciously competent. You can look at yourself and say, look, I'm actually doing something. I'm following the four regulative principles. I am chanting at least 16 rounds carefully every day. And even within that, there's refinement, how conscious you can become of how competent you are. And then as one advances in any kind of practice, he or she becomes unconsciously competent. It becomes, in other words, second nature habit. You imbibe that habit, you become the habit. It's not what you know, it's who you are. It's who you become. And when you look at a sadhu actually is a walking Bhagavatam. Their body looks like prasadam. They are devotional service. They're the abode of devotional service. They're effulgent and they're tasty. They're tasty. It says that in the Shriya Kanta Kanta Paramapurusha Kalpataravo, that all living beings are enjoyable and tasty. That's what Vaishnavas are. Because they're so full of nectar from practicing Krishna consciousness, they're actually drinking the water that's coming from the holy name, the spiritual water. And so they have that. Which is to make a plan. Get yourself a little book. This one was given to me as a gift, and I keep it in my pocket wherever I go, and the pen, make a plan. Write your plan down. You can write it tonight or you can write it tomorrow morning, but make a plan. Even if it's the simplest of plans and you write it down, I guarantee you, your day will be completely different. You decide what you want to do through your intelligence, which is higher than the mind, and make your plan, and then you'll know whether you're on plan or off plan. Now, that's a whole other topic, but you'll have the tools to subdue the mind, which is the master of all the senses, the center of all the senses. Did I give three yet? And the third one is to be deeply absorbed in service, so that when the senses come calling, you're busy. That's the best way that I find nowadays. For instance, if I'm on the campus at San Francisco State and I'm distributing books, it's one of the ways that people can avoid talking to me. They're on their cell phone or pretending they're on their cell phone. And that's a good excuse to walk by somebody who's soliciting, isn't it? In fact, I've used it myself. Sometimes I'm on my walk and I see somebody with a clipboard ready to you know, hit everyone up. And I just pull out my cell phone. And so that's what you do. With Maya, it's like your cell phone is your service, right? And when she comes and it's like with a clipboard and said, we'd like to sign you up for some nonsense. And you take out your service cell phone and it's like, sorry, I gotta go. I can't help you now. And actually, we talked about this the other day. What to do if you're talking to somebody and all of a sudden they start talking nonsense? And how do you get away? You just grab your pocket like your cell phone went off. Pretend, oh, hold on. It's on vibrate. And it's like, I gotta go. And you take off. So we plan ahead to subdue the senses. And a person who's faithful they have this feeling that dedicating my life to Krishna is the way of feeding the root and everything else will be taken care of. They're dedicated. They set aside a space for transcendental knowledge in their life. They chant a chapter a day. Did we even discuss, you know, Chad? Did we? We didn't mention Chad as a practical solution, that is, chapter a day, that your day is punctuated by chanting one chapter of Bhagavad Gita a day without fail. That's just what you do. Your office mates or whoever it is, they just see that you take off and you chant one chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And then there's Chad Plus, which is a chapter of Bhagavad Gita a day and a chapter of Bhagavatam a day. This is dedication. You're setting aside this time for transcendental knowledge. You're dedicated to it. And such a person who's dedicated to transcendental knowledge, who's faithful, and who subdues his or her senses will achieve it, will come to that position. So those are three areas, three categories, and three tips for subduing the senses. Now we'll take any reflections or questions. Reflection means any one thing that's stuck in your mind, an aha that you got from anything that you heard tonight that you're taking away with you. And when someone stops you in the parking lot and they say, what was the class about tonight? You'll say, this is what it was about. The one thing. Or a question. Gandharvika. A comment on Chad Plus.
No, Prabhu. The question that I had is, you told that by the fire of knowledge, the karma is burnt. Is it because we know what to do and what not to do, or because we are practicing? Because sometimes we know, but we may, just simply by having the knowledge, can the karma be burnt? Because the karma seems to be so strong and severe and cruel. So how do we say that simply by having the knowledge, the karma, the reactions will be burnt?
It is the first thing that you said is because you become aware of your real interest. Everyone is self-interested. We act for our self-interest. It's natural. But when I'm covered by ignorance, I don't know what my self-interest is. And therefore, I act sinfully. But when I am illuminated by knowledge, I know what my self-interest is. And any living entity who knows what their self-interest is will act in that way. And therefore, they avoid sense gratification because they know that it's detrimental to their well-being, to their spiritual well-being. So they're not interested in it. Now, as you mentioned, there may be a case where someone comes to knowledge but is overcome by sense gratification, even if they know, because of past habit. That's altogether possible, and that comes out in the verse, Api Chet Sudaracharo Bhajate Mam Ananya Bhak, that a person may be situated, may be in devotional service, but then may exhibit some loose character from time to time. But Krishna says because they're properly situated, they'll still come to the perfect situation. Again, in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Karabhajana Muni says, Sapadamulam bhajata priyasya tyaktanya bhavasya hari priyeshaha vikarma yachchot patitam katanchit dhunoti sarvam hridi sannivishtaha. That the devotee has a bhava to surrender to Krishna. And Krishna knows it because he's in the heart of the devotee. And the verse says that if for some reason the devotee descends into vikarma, Krishna makes up for it from within their heart because he knows their intention, their mood. So even though something bubbles up from the past, out of past habit, that will be rectified by Krishna. One only has to continue in devotional service, because by performing devotional service, Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janaya Yashuvairagyam Jnanam Chayarahaitukam, there's a concomitance of knowledge and detachment. And from knowledge comes detachment. If you have knowledge, then naturally you're detached. That's the result of it.
have just quick one more question, Prabhu. This may be silly, but I'm just trying to understand this verse and also the planning that you said. But in 4:22, Krishna says that he who is satisfied with gain which comes of its own accord means he is happy.
Yes.
So how then people ask, like, why do we plan? Because Krishna says that the devotee accepts.
Well, different kinds of planning. I mean, everyone makes some kind of plan. Our plan is for devotional service. How to be engaged and how to stay engaged in hearing and speaking Krishna Katha. That's not a material plan. So Narada Muni says, Tasyaiva heta prayate tako vinona labhyate tad brahmatad upariyada. Talabhyate dukha varanyata sukham kalena sarvatra gabhira ramhasa. That you shouldn't make plans for how to get more material enjoyment, because you may accumulate so many material things and someone will come and burgle your house and take all the stuff that you were trying to keep. It happens all the time. I just met somebody the other day. How are you? Not very good. What happened? Somebody burgled my house and they took all my money and all my jewelry and all this kind of stuff, they said. And they were morose, and I was trying to be philosophical and explain that, you know, you didn't ask for that, right? Nope. Well, similarly, when somebody, you know, calls you on the phone and says, guess what? I got $25,000 for you. You know, I'd like to give it to you. You didn't expect that either, but it just comes of its own accord. So he said on the material ledger, these things come of their own accord, and therefore you shouldn't try for them. They're already fixed up. And if you do try for them, then you throw yourself off balance. So therefore, the verse you quoted, yadritsha labha santushto, you should, yadritsha means be satisfied with things that come, you know, naturally of their own accord. But Narada said on the spiritual side, you can make all kinds of plans. You know, you can take all kinds of, in fact, Prabhupada talks about it as a risk, like he mentions in the Bhagavatam about Kardama Muni. Kardama Muni was an Atman, was a Bhajananandi, Atmananandi. He was happy just sitting for 10,000 years, you know, to contemplate the self. It's nectar just to sit in the forest. And, you know, if you're actually controlled the mind and you can see the super soul, you can sit there for 10,000 years. It's far beyond just entertaining. It's nectar. And some people are satisfied in doing that. And then Prabhupada said, but other people are Goshtiyanandis. And they accumulate all kinds of followers, and they live amongst the followers for the sake of the mission, Prabhupada says. And that's it's also, he said, it's risky. They don't. He says Atmananandis don't want to take that risk. And the point is that, what is the point? Oh, so you should for Goshtiyanandi, he makes all kinds of plans. You know, Prabhupada had plans all over the world. The Bombay project was a huge pain to get started. You can read about it in the Leelamrita about how Prabhupada, even though he was still traveling around the world, he put one manager after another to try to get the land deal done in Bombay, and they all had difficulty, every one of them. Then Prabhupada finally came there, and to the very end, it was a struggle to get that deed for the property because they tried to renege and take back. And finally he got the Bombay project. He had a big plan for that. He had a plan that, Krishna, I'm going to have a nice place for you, and then people come from all over the world. It'd be a first-class hotel here for Krishna consciousness. Same thing in Vrindavan. Prabhupada wanted the temple in Vrindavan, and that was hard. I mean, they promised him that they'd have that temple built in 1972, and it didn't open until 1975. And there was all kinds of delays, and they couldn't get the money, and then they couldn't get the right cement, and difficulties, big plans. So you can make plans for Krishna consciousness, but yadritsha labha santushto means from the material side, be satisfied with the gain that comes of its own accord. Yes.
I had one reflection while you were going over these various methods to subdue the senses, and you talked about three of them. And I was reminded about verses in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna goes into a discussion of the senses, where he even says that the senses are so strong and impetuous in chapter 2, verse 60, that they forcibly carry away the mind even of a man of discrimination who is endeavoring to control them. And then he tells Arjun about another way, which is part of the methods that you have mentioned. It's implicit in it. In 261, that one who restrains his senses, keeping them under full control, and fixes his consciousness upon me, is known as a man of steady intelligence. And he's trying to say here that only when the senses are controlled will one have steady intelligence. Without that, the person is going to be unsteady. So he's saying that by fixing your consciousness upon me, you will automatically control the senses and become a person of steady intelligence, which is one recommendation is giving. And in the purport to that verse 261, there is this example given of Durvasa Muni, who scolded Maharaj Ambarish. And in the process, Durvasa Muni got very angry, but Maharaj Ambarish remained very steady. And it says here that Maharaj Ambarish was completely absorbed. It cites a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam and says that King Ambarish fixed his mind on the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, engaged his words in describing the abode of the Lord, his hands in cleansing the temple of the Lord, his ears in hearing the pastimes of the Lord, his eyes in seeing the form of the Lord, his body in touching the body of the devotee, his nostrils in smelling the flavor of the flowers offered to the lotus feet of the Lord, etc., etc. And it said, and all these qualifications made him fit to become a Matpara devotee of the Lord. And it said here, the Matpara is very significant. That is what is completely controlling the senses only by the strength of devotional service to Krishna. So Krishna is, as we see in the Bhagavad Gita, often will emphasize that, think about me, fix your mind on me, and engage in devotional service. And that will also lead to control of the senses.
Well, it's a good point. And it is imperative that grihasthas do deity worship. It's recommended by all our acharyas, especially that grihasthas do deity worship. And the reason is that it engages the senses in a very pleasing way. Krishna reciprocates. He's beautiful, and everything around him is nice. And when you set up to do some puja for Krishna, with some worship for Krishna, everything's clean, everything smells good, Krishna looks good, and the whole process of offering to Krishna is so otherworldly. It's like nothing else you see anywhere else. It's not like putting gas in your car. It's not like filling out paperwork for your insurance. In fact, when I travel, I bring my puja paraphernalia with me, and when I go through security, a lot of times they look at it, because it's mostly metal, and they look, and then they call someone over, and they go, what is this? Because you can't put it in any category. You know, they take it out, and they look at it, and they have these little ghee lamps, you know, that are shaped like fish. And then, what else is there? There's a conch shell. What are you carrying a conch shell around for? Of course, if I'm dressed like this, they think anything, you know, you could be carrying anything. But it's really hard for them to figure out what that stuff is. You know, why do you have a little chamara fan and all this kind of stuff? And it's from the spiritual world. That's the only explanation. This is all stuff from the spiritual world. And so when you handle all those things and you take care of them and you clean them and then you worship Krishna, your senses become automatically absorbed. There are mantras to chant and memorize, and there's an order in which you wake up Krishna in the morning. And, you know, just waking up Krishna is such a ecstatic thing, because how is it that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who was mentioned in this verse of Sri Ishapanishad, you know, how is it that he sleeps? You know, most people don't have a conception of God that he can sleep, or, you know, you can tuck him in at night or something like that, give him some hot milk. But that's what goes on in the spiritual world, actually. You know, everyone's taking care of Krishna and bringing him nice things. And you can do that too. That was what the verse was we read today in the Ishapanishad, that Krishna is a person. He's a transcendental person. He's transcendentally attractive. He has senses. And when you please his senses through the archon process, you bring him things, like a little lamp. It's not hard to do. You just get a little ghee and some cotton. I forgot to bring my ghee wicks with me when I went to Big Sur. So I was just getting ready. I'm setting up for my puja, and I looked around, and there's no ghee wicks. So I did have some Q-tips that I keep, you know, for my puja. So I just pulled some cotton off, took a little ghee and put it on the, and then it lit, and I could offer a little flame. And Prabhupada talks about this, how nice it is that, he said, just like in the Ganges, people, they take Ganges water and then they offer it to the Ganges. And, you know, we take fire and all these other kinds of things and we offer them to Krishna. But the whole process becomes transcendentalized, and your senses become transcendentalized. And if you get in a regular pattern of worshiping Krishna, worshiping the deity, then your senses become controlled. And if you like to shop, you can shop all you want for Krishna. If you shop for yourself, you'll go crazy because it's hellish. And then you end up with a whole house full of stuff. You know, I've seen, you know, whole closets full of stuff that people never even use. Shoes that still have the tags on them. You know, how many pairs of shoes do you need? There's 50 in here. And, you know, half of them still have tags. The mind will just go crazy. Imelda Marcos had hundreds of pairs of shoes. She was the wife of the prime minister in Philippines, yeah. And she was famous for her shoes. I think she had a whole house just to keep shoes. You know, she had to build an extra house to take care of the shoes. And Jerry Seinfeld, you know, he became a multimillionaire from doing his show on television, and he collected Porsches. Sorry, Jerry, but, you know. He built a special garage just to keep the... he might be watching. He kept a special garage just to keep the temperature. And this is in New York, where real estate costs, you know, millions per, you know, one unit. And he had a special garage just to take care of all the hundreds of Porsches that he had in the middle of the city at a certain temperature, you know, so they'd be okay. So point is, you can lose your mind shopping for yourself, and it's unlimitedly agitating. And you can do the same thing for Krishna. You go into Delhi or Vrindavan, and in Vrindavan there's all these little places where you can go buy things for Krishna. You know, you go in the Mukutwala and you can sit there for hours and pick out things, and they'll just keep throwing them at you because they have millions of them. You know, you want this, want that, how about this? And you can just, you can spend all your money buying Didi outfits, and that's a good idea. That's recommended. That's this verse. He's a king, so he has unlimited resources, and he just gets everything for Krishna. So that kind of shopping, you know, you around the deity and worshiping the deity, it's necessary for householders to sit down and chant the mantras to do your puja. Even if it's simple, you have to sit down and do your mantras every day for Krishna. Sit down and do a few mantras for Krishna, because then it'll regulate your senses and he'll reciprocate. He reciprocates back when you do your mantras. You should have some little thing. You should bring him some fresh water at least and some tulsi. And to do that, you got to find tulsi leaves, right? And some flowers. Then you make a plan how to plant flowers in your yard. And you should, you know, you think, oh, let's dig this up. I know some devotees here thinking about digging their whole yard up now to start planting flowers for Krishna. That's a good thing. That's how you get engaged. And all that revolves around Archan, around the deity. So householders have to worship the deity. Some brahmacharis, they can be on the road just preaching 24 hours a day and work till they're exhausted, take a little rest and get up the next day, and they'll be blissful, happy. But householders, if you have to sign insurance papers, you're a grihastha. There's health insurance, there's life insurance, there's car insurance, there's fire insurance, there's trip insurance, there's all kinds of insurance. If you have to deal with insurance, you're a grihastha. So then you have to do archan. And that's the only thing that will relieve you from all that anxiety, from all that insurance that you have to carry, is worshiping Krishna, because he's the only real assurance. Samasrita ye padapalava plavam mahat param punya yasho marare bhavambudir vatsapadam param padam 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 yavi padam natesham. That's why there is insurance, because padam padam yad vipadam. There's danger at every step, and everybody knows it, so they try to psych you out and make you pay for insurance. But if you take shelter of Krishna by worshiping the deity and doing your puja, sit down, do a few mantras every day. Bring Krishna something nice. Grow him some flowers and get him some nice outfits. And then you'll be happy. He'll smile at you. He smiles at you. And you can bring him nice oils. I get these oils from Gulab Singh in Delhi. I don't think I have one on me now. But, when I offer them to my deity every day, then I put them in a tiny little plastic bag, and then they stay fresh for a long time. And then I give them out to people. I say, here, take this. And they look at it and say, what the heck is this? And then I say, smell it. And they go, whoa, that smells really good. It's aromatherapy. You get aromatherapy when you do archan. In the best kind of way, there's flowers, there's incense. Who gets to smell incense in the suburbs? There's horrible smells in the suburbs. But when you burn incense, every day when I do my puja, I take some of the incense outside and I put it on the porch, and it blows all over the whole neighborhood, and I know it's getting people everywhere. Gandharvika, you were going to say? Oh. So this is another way that Rakshit Prabhu has brought up to our attention, to follow in the footsteps of Ambarish Maharaj, to control the senses by doing this kind of archan, to worship the deity. Do a few mantras for Krishna every day and offer him at least some water. Polish some things for him. And then you feel happy. It purifies the heart when you do that. And you have to be there too. It's like having a kid. If you're taking care of the deity, you have to show up. Like with a baby, right? In fact, one acharya says that, it's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he said, the appearance of bhakti in the life of the devotee, when the pure devotion starts to awaken in the heart, he said, it's like the birth of a baby girl. How delicate is a baby girl? I've seen a baby girl's born, lots of them recently. And the parents, they're there all the time, right? With baby girl, you're thinking, is the wind blowing on her too hard? Is the light, move her over here? I mean, you're constantly taking care of a baby girl because there's, she's so delicate and she's a baby and you have to be there for her all the time. So in deity worship also, when we actually realize that Krishna is there in the deity form, then we should feel like that, attentive. And that takes our mind away from any kind of other nonsense that Maya might suggest. That I would, but I'm busy because I got to take care of Krishna. I got to take care of my deities. So that's another way to always keep the senses controlled. And it's necessary for grihasthas especially. Question?
One quick question, Prabhuji. Actually, regarding this controlling the senses, I had one experience. Due to past habits, we go on doing some things and we want to really stop it. But we cannot stop it because of past habits. But we are trying to stop the bad habit or sinful habit. But in due course of time, some reactions come again that will grow. I mean, the tendency to do the habit grows more than before. So, and when taking up to Krishna consciousness or chanting, it feels like it is exaggerated. I have really felt that feeling while controlling the senses. They go more wild. So is it for me or is it very common?
Is it just me or is it?
Or please tell me.
It's not
me.
Just you. No, this is very common. Look to Arjuna. He said much the same thing when Krishna advised him about controlling the senses and the mind. Arjuna said, "Yeah, but it, you know, come on, it's impossible." He said, "It's like the wind." And he said, "It's chanchalam himana Krishna pramati bhalavadrinam." He says, "The mind's chanchal. It's flickering. It's mad. It's obstinate. It's strong, and it's very determined." You know, so it's difficult. So it's a gradual process. The most important thing is to keep the positive aspects of devotional service. Especially, you have to chant Hare Krishna. That's the most important of all the aspects, is to chant Hare Krishna, because Krishna's name is especially powerful. Nam Nam Akari Bahuda Nija Sarva Shaktis. All of Krishna's personal potencies are there in the holy name. And if you chant good japa, in fact, I'll tell you a story. I just heard this on the way down here from my good friend Divyanga. He was reminding me. We were just sort of reminiscing, as we do every once in a while. I was on the phone with him, and he was saying, "Remember this, remember that." It's nice to think back and remember things in devotional service. So we lived in the Chicago Temple together. It was in Evanston on Emerson Street, which is right next to Northwestern University. It was a great neighborhood, and it was an old YMCA building that we had for the deities there, Kishore Kishori, and we used to go to the O'Hare Airport every day to distribute books. That was our service as brahmacharis. We just go out on book distribution every day, and it was a big deal going on book distribution, especially Friday and Saturday. Friday night was the big night, and you know, the newsletter used to be, the Sankirtan newsletter used to be, what was your best 2 days out of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday? You could take your best 2 days and report those. So devotees all over America were out on Fridays all day, some of them, and all night sometimes, you know, trying to have a big day on Friday. So it would be a big, big push. There was one devotee in our temple. His name is Manasuta Das, great soul. And actually right now I think he's just visiting in Colorado. I wish we could bring him out here, Manasuta. Anyway, so Manasuta, he became one of the biggest book distributors in the temple. And he had a technique for how he distributed so many books. And that was his japa. He was known for his japa. In the temple room, we'd all be there, and he was so fixed on his japa. If someone came and asked him a question, he would totally ignore it. He would not talk during japa. And his japa was so intense, you could watch him. He did not miss a syllable or a mantra. He was fully fixed on his japa. He would sometimes stand or sometimes sit, but he would fully focus on chanting good japa. And he would go out, and it was like magic watching him at O'Hare Airport. Everyone he talked to, in fact, he had this technique. He would tap the book like this. "Buddy, buddy." And he'd tap the book like this. In fact, we used to walk around and imitate him and go, "Hey, buddy, buddy, buddy." And people would just come over, and they would just sell one book after another. Tens, then 20s, then 30s, 40s, 50s, hundreds of books he would do. Big books in O'Hare Airport. It was like watching was like magic, because practically he wasn't saying anything that special. It was just his intensity. And so people would always come up to him because he would be top on the newsletter. He's selling so many books. And then people would always come from everywhere, and they say, "Is that Manasuta?" And you go, "Yeah." And I got to ask him a question. "How do you sell so many books?" He'd say, "Japa." That's all he'd say. In fact, they'd ask him during japa sometimes, and he wouldn't talk to them. And afterwards, they'd come up and say, "So tell us, what's the secret? How do you do so many books?" And he'd go, "Japa." So japa is the key. If you want to control your senses and give up bad habits, develop this one good habit of chanting japa. Like, it's the most, everything comes from that. Krishna's there in his holy name. If you fully concentrate on that, your senses will be automatically controlled, because Krishna is Hrishikesh. He's Mukunda. He's all powerful. He's there in his name. So take full shelter of the holy name, just like you have no other business. Be a fanatic about that. You know, if someone comes up and says, "Hey, by the way, the stock market's up," you know, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna." Keep chanting. And that's your secret. So Krishna says that as much in the second chapter. Vishaya vinivartante niraharasa dehina rasavarjam rasopyasya param drishva nirvartate. What a beautiful verse. He's saying in the beginning you restrain your senses because you know you're supposed to. And it's hard. And you're thinking, this is hard. I'm restraining my senses. But when you actually get the higher taste, it's not hard. It's you're tasting something better, and it's your nature to go for the better thing. So the better thing is available in the holy name. You have to get it. So you have control over that. You can improve your chanting of Hare Krishna, and you can increase the frequency and the duration of your chanting if you want to. Nobody can stop you. If you decided all of a sudden you were going to chant 64 rounds a day, who could stop you? I'm not recommending that you necessarily do this, but I'm just asking the question, who could stop you? Anybody? The government? Your husband probably wouldn't try to stop you. Nobody can stop you. You have your own volition. You're a soul. You can move as you wish. You can make advancement in Krishna consciousness as you wish. So find out where the power is. It's in the holy name, and do it. And take that. You will come to a higher level. Every Shastra says it. Every great Mahajan says it. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, there's nothing to be had in the 14 worlds except the holy name. It's come here to give you all benediction. Make a, you know, your whole life based on that, and you'll get a higher taste. And even if you don't have, even if you don't experience the highest ecstasy when you're chanting, if you're fixed like that, if you do it like some people, they exercise and they're really regulated about it every day. I'm sorry, I'm going jogging. I'm staying in shape. I do it like this. They may not be getting a super high taste, but they're fixed. So if you stay fixed in your japa, you will be able to control your senses. When those habits come, that one mustard seed of inspiration you got when you were chanting 16 rounds, it may come to you. It'll come to you mostly unexpected. You'll be chanting your 16 rounds with a vow with that I will stay fully focused here. And out of nowhere, all of a sudden, you'll feel some special inspiration in your heart. It'll come as Krishna's mercy. And therefore, Atashi Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Graim Indre Sevan Mukihi Jivado Swayameva Spuratyada. Spuratyada means Krishna appears to somebody who serves him diligently with the tongue. That's what the verse says. Just by chanting, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. And you have your choice of how to do service when you're chanting. You can do it lackadaisically, which means just, you know, like you're barely into it, or you can put your whole heart and soul into it. And if you serve like that, if someone comes and serves you with their whole heart and soul, do you notice them? You notice, right? If someone just came and they just started doing all kinds of services for you tonight, that you'd immediately notice them. So in the same way, Krishna will notice you, that you're taking full responsibility to concentrate your mind and bring it back and chant the holy name. And if you do that, you'll get a higher taste. And those bad habits, when they come, you'll have the power to move beyond them. They won't affect you. They'll be like serpents with the teeth removed. And you see that in India sometimes, the kids, you know, they bring these snakes around in a basket and try to scare people. And nobody's scared because the snake is no teeth. So the desires may show up. The habit may show up, but you go like, nah, ha, ha, ha. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Because you have the holy name. Hare Krishna. So it's just a little after 8 o'clock. Let's have the artik. And We took advantage of this time. It's a miracle that we can all come to this one place and hear and chant about Krishna. This process of hearing Krishna Katha together as a group is the process for self-realization. So go on hearing, even if it doesn't feel like you're getting the effect right now. Line yourself up every day to hear Krishna Katha and chant Hare Krishna. And all success will be there. Param Vijayate Shri Krishna Sankirtanam Gaur Premanande Haribo! Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai! So let's put all the books, Shastra deities, away with great respect and efficiency. And we'll put all the asanas away and we'll have the artik. Hare Krishna. Jai!